Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
The legislature's new map gets the go-ahead from a judge, but critics say it still fails to make the big changes Florida needs.
They didn't want to do anything about that because it protects the Republican performance of District 10.
Also this week, we'll hear the latest on a new council looking at potential legislation for next year to continue cutting down on human trafficking in Florida.
You know, it's changing the perception. These are victims. And these young women, whether they're taken out of a strip club and they're addicted to drugs, they are victims.
We'll also hear the story of a man caught in a strange legal and bureaucratic quagmire inside a Florida mental hospital. We may even wind up with a bucket of ice water poured over our heads. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Here's the latest on a story we've been following for many weeks. Lawmakers, lawyers, and the League of Women Voters converged on a Leon County courtroom this week to argue the merits of Florida's newly revised congressional districts. Nick Evans reports parties to the case did not see eye to eye in testimony leading up to the judge's decision.
Stakeholders in Florida's redistricting fight appeared in court Wednesday. The subject of debate? A new congressional map drafted and passed by the legislature earlier this month. For anyone who's not up to speed on the issue, here's a refresher. After a protracted legal battle, Circuit Judge Terry Lewis ruled two of the congressional districts that came out of the revision in 2011 violated Florida's constitutional fair districts provisions. He ordered the legislature to redraw the map, and it completed its changes August 11th. Wednesday's hearing gave voting rights groups a chance to respond. Attorneys for the plaintiffs argue the new maps do little to address the concerns that led Lewis to call for a new map. League of Women Voters attorney David King.
Coalition plaintiffs, it is our position that the amendment, the map 9057, continues the unconstitutional district fact. They have not made any effort to change the heart of the court's findings about District 5.
District 5 runs on a north-south axis from Jacksonville to the Orlando area and borders District 10, the other invalidated district, in the Central Florida region. In the unconstitutional version of the map, Lewis pointed out a number of so-called appendages on these districts that seemed to pack Democratic-leaning African-American communities into 5, thus making 10 more reliably Republican. The revised map removes these appendages, and attorney for the Florida House, George Maris, says that's all the judge asked the legislature to do.
This court identified two problems. We addressed them completely and precisely as the court ordered. And in doing so, the staff made a remarkable, successful effort to improve District 5 and the surrounding areas.
But attorneys for the plaintiffs say if District 5 ran east to west rather than north to south, it would allow for more compactness throughout the state and greater minority representation in Central Florida. King questioned Harvard professor and electoral map expert Stephen Ansola-Behar about a map proposed by the plaintiffs with an east-west District 5.
Look at the scores you find on all three of the metrics. It's more compact. Is that correct, sir?
Correct.
And then District 10 is also more compact on the metrics and visual?
Correct.
And how about District 11?
The District 11 is more compact as well.
Under the plaintiff's proposal, Ansola-Behar concedes District 2 is less compact, but every other affected district performs better than the legislature's map. Also, the plaintiffs argue the newest map was one-sided in its construction, crafted behind closed doors by Republican leaders before a special legislative session even began. In this exchange, House Minority Leader Perry Thurston responds to questions from Attorney John Devaney.
And were you invited to any of those meetings?
I was certainly not invited.
Do you know if a map came out of those meetings?
Yes, a map did come out of the meetings.
How do you know that?
Because it was represented to us that this is how this map that we're here to deal with today was formulated based on those meetings and subsequent meetings that they had.
Maris shot back that Democrats did not invite Republicans to participate on a competing proposal offered by Kissimmee Democratic Senator Darren Soto. Judge Terry Lewis closed the hearing shortly after noon Wednesday with the promise to render his ruling soon. Late Friday, Lewis made good on that promise, releasing a ruling upholding the legislature's new map and allowing this year's elections to proceed under the borders previously ruled unconstitutional. Challenges are expected to follow. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida is ranked number 3 in the U.S. for the number of calls received at the nation's human trafficking hotline. To curb that trend, state and local officials have worked with lawmakers over the years to put new laws in place. And as Sasha Cordner tells us, a newly formed council is hatching plans to build on the state's past progress and propose new legislation for next year.
According to the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, 7% of the human trafficking-related calls to its National Human Trafficking Hotline is coming from Florida. That's put the state in the number 3 spot, which Attorney General Pam Bondi says has a silver lining.
You heard we're 3rd in the number of calls to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. It's good in a way in that that means a lot of awareness has been brought to it in Florida. So we're receiving a lot of calls.
Bondi, who's made anti-trafficking efforts a main priority, is now the head of the Statewide Council on Human Trafficking, which recently convened for the first time. Made up of various backgrounds, the goal of the 15-member council is to work together to help put an end to human trafficking in Florida.
People think that the majority of these children are undocumented immigrants, and many are, and they are just as much a victim as anyone else. But we're being told that the majority of them are from within our country. A lot of the kids are runaways. A lot of the kids have been bumped from foster home to foster home. A lot of the kids have aged out of foster care and have nowhere to go. They end up in strip clubs. They're immediately addicted to drugs. So to keep them captive.
Building on that, Miami-Dade Assistant State Attorney Susan Dechevitz says she'd like to see legislation that outlines new ways to present evidence that helps prevent further victimization for those trafficked.
We are trying to create other forms of evidence so that when we have a victim who we cannot rely on because of their psychological condition, that we want to develop the cyber evidence. You know that line that is not quite becoming trite yet, but hopefully one day it will. If a girl won't talk, her cell phone will.
Also on the panel is Martin County Sheriff William Snyder, who's a former Republican lawmaker. He helped author legislation in the House in 2011 dealing with human trafficking. Those laws remain on the books today. But Snyder says now Florida's current trafficking statutes need some tightening. He says he'd first like to see increased penalties for those who use the services of trafficked females.
And then the other one we have a tremendous problem with in the a massage industry where I think some of our worst trafficking occurs. We have a hard time based on the solicitation, the wording of the solicitation statute itself is that they really have figured out a way to just go about their business almost impervious to law enforcement by the way they do it.
Others want more of a focus on labor trafficking, not just sex trafficking. And according to Terry Coonan, there's more labor trafficking victims throughout Florida than sex trafficking victims. He's the executive director of Florida State University Center for the Advancement of Human Rights, who Bondi calls the human trafficking guru.
Some of that is due to the nature of labor trafficking. Typically, it is a subcontractor, that is the trafficker, but it is a large U.S. corporation or business, either looking the other way or choosing not to ask too many questions, that goes for the low bid, the low subcontract that actually is based on slave labor. And we continue to see cases throughout our resort and our hotel industries. We continue to see it in agriculture. We see it in restaurants around Florida. A number of places where trafficking continues to thrive.
Still, he says Florida has made some strides, including in the courts, with several convicted traffickers receiving life sentences for their crimes. But he says there are still some gaps that need to be filled, like providing more privileges for trafficking victims advocates who represent victims, as well as allowing victims to sue.
We need to have trafficking victims that have the ability to sue their traffickers for punitive damages. What we understand both here in Florida and around the country is that it's not enough to go after what we might call the low-hanging fruit, the low-level traffickers. We have to work our way up the trafficking chain. We have to get at the assets. And that is very, very true of massage enterprises. It's very, very true of the organized crime syndicates that we're increasingly seeing here in Florida.
And Bondi says what she's heard from the stakeholders so far is encouraging.
What we're trying to do here today is develop a comprehensive program, because you can't just put these victims in a safe house. They need drug counseling. They need medical treatment. They truly need psychological counseling. And they also need to become strong survivors, where they can testify at trial and not be scared of these absolute monsters who are capturing them. And so we're going to do everything in our power to lock these monsters up for as long as possible and protect our victims.
Bonnie's next step is to split the 15-member council into three groups, and their next planned meeting is set for later in the fall. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a fight at a Florida hospital that treats mentally ill patients highlights the difficulty of treating people with mental illnesses.
So they're trying to dope me up and make me walk around here like a zombie, so I don't have to fight this case, because I'm so close at the end.
A panhandle congressman is pushing his bill to prevent federal overreach of water, but some in Florida question his motives.
What it implies is that we want the special interests behind the scene to have a say, but we don't want the public involved.
The Ice Bucket Challenge has made its way to Florida, but will its effects be lasting, or will they quickly melt away?
I would like to think that, you know, come a year from now, I'll be like, oh yes, I want to do that. You know, whether it's doing another bucket of ice on my head and donating.
One of Florida's last remaining hospitals for mentally ill patients needs volunteers for its guardian advocacy program. But as Lynn Hatter reports, difficult patients, complicated illnesses, and tricky state laws make that a very hard job to do.
Most of the patients at the Florida State Hospital in Chattahoochee have been sent there because they have an acute mental illness. Part of the hospital's function is to restore people deemed incompetent to stand trial to competency. In the case of Levenston Horn, there's a difference between being competent and being sane.
I was found NGI. I get worried of insanity.
What led to the NGI finding?
They say I was ill at the time of the crime. And the jury found me not guilty of insanity.
For more than a year, Horn has been fighting with hospital administrators, waging a fight through court orders and administrative challenges. In a series of letters sent to WFSU earlier this year, Horn claims the hospital has denied him a guardian advocate, something Florida law says he has a right to.
I asked for an advocate, the hospital say they doesn't do that here. And I was like, why? I said, I need one here, because I feel like that I'm depressed and I need someone to fill in to see if I can take different medication if I need it. And they just was going to go over it to make sure nobody screw me over with medication or whatever. They was going to be there to sit in the treatment team and my meetings and stuff like that to make sure everything go good so I can get out and go home early.
Horn's goal is to eventually be released from Florida State Hospital, and he believes the staff are intentionally obstructing him. But Florida State Hospital's lawyer, Jeff Richardson, says it's important to know who is doing the talking.
Mr. Horn was charged with murder in Miami-Dade County, allegedly had killed his mom and his dad, and attempted to kill his sister as well.
That happened in Miami in 1996, and Horn says he'd been hearing voices at the time. Psychologists who evaluated Horn said he suffers from a type of disorder that can't be cured. In 2007, a judge suggested Horn not be released until he had 11 consecutive years of no symptoms. He had relapsed twice by 2009. Richardson.
The doctors have found it difficult to determine what instigates or sets Mr. Horn's illness off. the court says, and I'm quoting from the order, if one is observing or supervising the defendant, he can appear fine for a period of time which can exceed a five-year period and then have a relapse again. The problem is if the defendant's relapses or the defendant relapses and it goes unnoticed or untreated, it can have dire and detrimental consequences for himself and others.
State law says a person who has been found not guilty by reason of insanity has the same rights as a person civilly committed. One of those rights is a guardian advocate, a person who can act independently of a treatment team and make decisions about a patient's care. In order to get a guardian, a person has to stop consenting to treatment. When a person does consent to their treatment, they're not eligible for the program. It's an apparent catch-22, but Richardson explains it this way.
When you're looking at the need for a guardian advocate, the statute requires that the person be incompetent to consent to treatment. So what that means is a person is incompetent because they lack the insight into their illness to realize that they need treatment.
In a series of documents Horn sent to WFSU, he outlines exchanges with hospital administrators, Department of Children and Families officials, even the governor's office, repeatedly raising the issue of a guardian advocate. The paper trail spans from January of last year to this past April, but Horn didn't stop consenting to his treatment until April, and a judge deemed him incompetent in May. Horn finally got on a waiting list for a guardian advocate in June, but Richardson says there's a shortage of volunteers for the program.
We've got 187 residents of our total 936 who have guardian advocates, and 39 of those 187 are represented by volunteer guardian advocates. Only 8 of those are historically forensic residents.
Richardson says finding volunteers to advocate for people like Horn is tough. Meanwhile, Horn is frustrated.
So they're trying to dope me up and make me walk around here like a zombie so I don't have to fight this case because I'm so close at the end. And ma'am, I'm not a threat to myself and others.
Whether Horn is ever released ultimately depends on a judge. And in recent court filings, Florida State Hospital administrators recommend he stay at the facility. Richardson says this case highlights what's become a constant struggle, the difficulty in treating mental illnesses.
We need to understand a segment of our population that is not easy to access. All this time, a person who committed a crime like Mr. Horn, we've been trying to try to treat him and improve his symptoms. I think an awareness of that is a good takeaway.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
As the federal government seeks to clarify which water bodies it protects, a Florida congressman came to Tallahassee this week to decry what he calls a gross overreach of power and also to tout his legislation blocking the effort. But as Jessica Palumbo reports, Florida environmental groups and former state regulators say the federal clarification is necessary to protect Florida's fresh water from pollution.
State Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam joined Panama City Republican Congressman Steve Sutherland for a press conference hyping his bill, the Waters of the United States Regulatory Overreach Protection Act of 2014. Sutherland sums up his concerns like this.
When the EPA proposed an outrageous new rule that would expand its regulatory authority under the Clean Water Act to include almost any body of water, from puddles to ditches to pipes to farmland ponds, I wanted to return to Tallahassee, the heart of our district, to begin our fight anew.
I'm not even sure it's possible that he personally read the regulations.
Vicki Schinkel is former secretary of the Florida Department of Environmental Regulation. She says she's mystified at Sutherland's characterization of the proposed rules. For one, she says they actually exempt farm ditches and ponds as they have since the 1970s. Second, she says they don't expand the federal government's jurisdiction. What they do, she says, is give extra detail about what qualify as protected headwaters that become tributaries that flow into lakes and rivers.
This conversation has to happen, and a decision has to be made, not just to protect the water bodies, but those people who have to do work around these areas knows which are protected and which require permits and which don't.
Schinkel says people who farm or build structures or roads need to know the difference. And because two recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions have muddled Clean Water Act definitions, clarifying them is crucial. The EPA estimates an additional 3% of water bodies would be indisputably protected. But at the press conference, Commissioner Putnam warned of incredibly broad regulation.
Folks, your front yard is mushy in North Florida right now. Should that be subject to Corps of Engineers regulation?
Florida environmentalists say the fear-mongering doesn't reflect the EPA's plan. Sarah DeFlesco is Florida Program Director for a group called Clean Water Action.
This is not something new. These wetlands and streams have been historically protected, and so I don't think we need to start from scratch and create a whole new consultation process for it.
Sutherland's bill requires the EPA come up with an alternative to the current proposal after discussing with state and local officials. He has 120 House co-sponsors. But former Florida water regulator Schinkel says they're being backed by industry groups who haven't liked the Clean Water Act from the beginning.
That anti-regulatory movement isn't pushing against what's happening new today. They are pushing against things that have been in existence since the 1970s.
The EPA is taking public comment on the rules through late October. Meanwhile, Sutherland's bill is heading for a House floor vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Jacksonville State Representative Reggie Fullwood has lost his bid to qualify for re-election. That word came today out of a Tallahassee courtroom. Leon County Circuit Judge James Hankinson ruling that a notary's failure to sign one of Fullwood's qualifying documents was enough to knock him out of the race. Hankinson said no judge wants to keep a candidate off the ballot, but the legislature has signaled that it wants the qualifying requirements strictly enforced. Fullwood, who's a Democrat, had been running unopposed this year. The judge's decision means the state will have to call a special election. Fullwood says he doesn't know if anyone will challenge him now. Still, he says he'll file for re-election again when the state announces dates for another qualifying period. You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, if you've opened a newspaper, browsed the internet, or turned on the TV lately, chances are you've heard of the Ice Bucket Challenge. It's a campaign to raise money and also awareness for ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The challenge is sweeping the nation, and as Regan McCarthy reports, that includes Florida.
I'm Attorney General Pam Bondi.
I'm Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater.
I'm Ag Commissioner Adam Putnam.
And we accept the Ice Bucket Challenge, and we nominate
the Tallahassee Press Corps.
For those who haven't seen one of the thousands of Ice Bucket Challenge videos posted to various social media sites by everyone from Kermit the Frog.
Coming to you from the hot, sticky swamp where I am ready to accept the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge.
To former President George W. Bush.
I do not think it's presidential for me to be splashed with ice water, so I'm simply going to write you a check.
Ow! Here's how it works. Participants are challenged by their friends to dump a bucket of icy water over their heads. They post that video online and challenge someone else. University of South Florida Mass Communications Professor Kelly Burns says that simplicity is part of what makes the campaign work.
Everybody can make a video, put it online, share the video, tag some friends, and encourage them to do it as well.
But despite its popularity, the challenge is receiving some criticism. The rules for the challenge aren't clear. Some question when they're expected to donate and how much. And others worry it's not really teaching anybody about ALS. But Tallahassee resident Mary Margaret Dale, who has both participated and donated, says that's not the case for her. She says because of the campaign, she's taken the time to learn more about the disease.
I knew it by Lou Gehrig's disease. I would have never known, like, associated ALS with that. And I'm probably not alone. There are probably a lot of people that didn't know what that is. And because of this crazy little campaign, you know, it's now on people's mind what this is, what it does, and people are thinking about it.
But now that she's learned about the disease, will Dale donate again next year? She admits she's not sure, but she says she is more likely to than she would have been before the challenge, when she didn't know about ALS or the people it affects. The challenge has been questioned by people who call it a publicity stunt, saying it isn't sustainable. Byrne says that's probably true, adding she expects as the summer ends and people head back to school, we'll see fewer and fewer Ice Bucket Challenge videos. And she says updating the idea for a new season isn't likely to work. But Burns points out while the benefits for ALS research may decrease, the challenge has likely started a lasting donation legacy.
People have embraced it and are at least thinking about, hey, I should give money to organizations. I should give money to charities. In general.
Burns says the challenge has created the opportunity for parents to talk with their children about the importance of giving and given people who may not have donated before a chance to try it. Donations attributed to the Ice Bucket Challenge total more than $50 million. ALS Association officials say that comes from existing donors and more than 1 million new donors. Marketing director for the ALS Association's Florida chapter, Alyssa Gutierrez, says that's a step up from the group's typical funding.
We only have one real source of funding, and that's the Department of Defense. Military veterans are twice as likely to be diagnosed with ALS, and we really don't know why. So the Department of Defense, you know, every year their budget gives us around $6 or $7 million, which is a drop in the bucket.
Gutierrez says something to keep in mind when donating is that often money stays where it's donated. She says donating to the Florida chapter will pay for care for Florida residents, as well as advocacy and research. ALS is an incurable disease that attacks a person's nerve cells in the brain and spinal cord, deteriorating a person's ability to control their muscle movements. A person in the later stages of ALS sometimes becomes completely paralyzed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Nick Evans, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.